Audiobook in MP3 of the Book of Griba. Communication with the Spirit World. ITS Laws and Purpose. Personal Experiences of a Catholic Priest. By Johannes Griba. Fight for the truth until death, and God will fight for you. Zürich 4:28. Translated from the German second edition. Copyright of German original, 1932 by Johannes Griba. Introduction. These people scoff at anything they do not understand. Is there for mankind a life after death? Is there a beyond? Is there a world of spirits, into which the spirits of human beings are received after leaving the body? And how shall we picture life in that other world? What fate is in store for us there? Or does everything come to an end within the cemetery walls? When we bury the body there, do we inter the spirit also, and is nothing left of man? Of all his hopes and fears, of all his struggles and cares, of all his joys and sorrows, of all his good deeds and bad, but a skull or a handful of ashes. Again and again, these questions assail us. In the silent hours of serious illness they bear heavily upon the weary human heart. At every death bed at which we stand, behind every coffin we follow, they tug at our soul. They arise from the mound above each grave, and are cut deeply into every tombstone. Who will solve for us the great puzzle of the beyond? To whom shall we carry our doubts that we may learn the real truth? Shall we ask the various religions and their ministers? They teach us to believe in a hereafter and in the survival of the spirit of man, it is true. But they weaken the force of their own teachings by denying the living on of the spirits of animals. For if animals do not live on, for what particular reason should the human race? Mankind and animals have the same destiny. Both are conceived and born in the same way. Both experience pleasure and pain, right and wrong, and one dies as does the other. This is confirmed by the Bible in the words, "The fate of man and the fate of the animals is one and the same. As one dies, so does the other, the same breath is in them all. Man is no better than the animals. Both are bound for the same end, both sprang from the dust, and to the dust they both return. Who can tell if the life breath of man goes upward, while the life breath of an animal goes down into the earth? Moreover, the various churches hold conflicting views on the most important questions of religion. We can, therefore, not look to them for a conclusive answer. Man, being fallible, is not a reliable guide in these matters. To reach the truth concerning these questions there is but one way. If there is a beyond, peopled by a world of spirits, we can obtain conclusive proof only if those spirits themselves will visit and enlighten us, for they alone can tell us the truth about the great questions relating to an afterlife. As long as the gap between the spirit world and our own remains unbridged, we shall remain in the darkness of uncertainty and endure the pangs of gnawing doubt. But today, people laugh at those who merely mention the possibility of communication between spirits and the world of man. They laugh and ridicule, just as people have always ridiculed any views that conflicted with the popular beliefs of their time. When Galileo taught that the earth revolves and the sun stands still, his contemporaries regarded him as mentally disturbed. The church looked upon him as a heretic and excommunicated him. He was thrown into prison, and was able to put an end to his sufferings and persecution only by retracting what he had proclaimed. When the first telephone was demonstrated at the Academy of Sciences in Paris, one of the most eminent professors of that institution called the whole thing a hoax, carried out by means of ventriloquy. The same thing happened to all proclaimers of a new truth. Their contemporaries ridiculed, disdained, insulted, burned or crucified them. So the world today laughs at those who seek to prove to mankind that there is a spirit world that is not barred to mankind, but with which we can communicate if we go about it in the right way and if we observe the necessary requirements. For there are laws governing the spirit world as immutable as any in force in the world of matter. The doctrine regarding communication between the spirit world and man has been given the name of Spiritism. Today this word is in poor repute among the masses, although very few people really know what it means. Spiritism is regarded as a ludicrous fantasy of ill-balanced minds. People speak of those spiritistic fools with a sneer. These people scoff at anything they do not understand. In this battle against Spiritism, the churches are fighting in the front lines. This is indeed difficult to explain, for those self-same churches teach that they have received their religious truths through communication with the spirit world. Judaism and Christianity are based upon the testimony of the Old and the New Testaments and hence rest entirely upon Spiritism, for of all Spiritist works, the greatest is the Bible, the larger part of whose contents hinges upon messages sent hither from the beyond. At every turn in the scriptures we read of communication between the spirit world and our own. The churches are therefore in no position to deny the communication with the spirit world that is reported in the Bible, unless they are prepared to saw off the limb upon which they themselves are seated. They try to defend their battle against Spiritism by asserting that attempts to communicate with the spirit world are forbidden by the Bible, citing the injunction, "You shall not question the dead." Just what does the Bible mean by questioning the dead? When the Bible speaks of the dead, it does not mean those spirits that have become separated from the body by mortal death, but those who are spiritually dead. Death, according to the scriptures, is the separation of the spirit from God. The dead are therefore those who have been separated from God because of their unbelief and defection. They are the spirits of darkness. The kingdom of the dead is the kingdom of Lucifer, the realm of the opponents of God, the realm of lies and disaster. According to the scriptures, there is a kingdom of the dead and a kingdom of the living. It is within our power to communicate with spirits in either of these kingdoms. We can seek counsel of the spiritually dead, in which case we would be consulting evil spirits, or, as the Bible terms it, questioning the dead. Or, we may turn to the living in the beyond, which would be seeking counsel from the good spirit world, or, as the Bible puts it, inquiring of God. To seek counsel from the dead, that is, from the world of spirits separated from God, would be the greatest possible affront to God. It would be idolatry, which consists of communicating with evil spirits. The necromancers of old were generally recognized as being, knowingly and deliberately, in communication with the powers of darkness, the demons. Hence God's stringent command voiced in the Old Testament, to root out the necromancers from among the people. There is, therefore, only one clearly defined kind of communication with spirits that the scriptures forbid, namely, communication with the evil spirits. On the other hand, it is the duty of mankind to seek communion with God and with the good spirit world. When someone tells you to consult necromancers, ask them if a people should not rather consult their God. Why should they consult the dead on behalf of the living? The invitation to inquire of God was enthusiastically accepted by the faithful of all ages. Among the Israelites it was a matter of daily occurrence. Everyone who wanted to inquire of the Lord went out into the tabernacle of the congregation. God gave his answer in an endless variety of ways. His spirit messengers were in constant touch with the faithful. We find references to them throughout the Old and New Testaments. If, therefore, we, as faithful servants of God, or, at least, as honest seekers after the truth, try to get into touch with the good spirit world, we are committing no sin, but rather obeying one of God's commandments. It is an important commandment, for only through contact with the good spirit world can we arrive at the truth. There is no other way. For this reason, nowhere in the entire scriptures are the seekers after truth told to go for guidance to their fellow men, but always to God and his spirits. This holds true also for the New Testament. At the time of his departure from the earth, there were many things which Christ still wanted to tell his followers and which they did as yet not understand. These matters were to be more fully explained to them later, however not by any human agency, but through God's spirits, which Christ would send them as messengers of the truth, whose actions would be discernible by the human senses. You shall see God's spirits ascending and descending. This ascent and descent of God's messengers was witnessed by the early Christians at their gatherings, whence the exhortation of the Apostle Paul to all Christians, endeavor to communicate with the spirits. It is fundamental for the religious life of mankind that the truth about the great questions of life and the beyond be sought not of men or in their interpretations, but by direct communication with God's spirit realm, which is the source of all truth. So God teaches us in the Old Testament, and Christ in the New. So, also, we are taught by the apostles, and these teachings were obeyed by God's people before the birth of Christ and by the Christians of the early centuries. As time went on, this fundamental doctrine was blotted out. Erring men usurped God's place and that of His Spirit messengers as prophets of the truth. The preaching of the Word of God became a trade, to use the Apostle Paul's expression. Religion was imparted by human teachers, just like any worldly knowledge. And so it has remained down to the present day. The spiritual leaders of the people became absolute lords in all matters pertaining to religion, and in this way accumulated ever-increasing worldly power. Ever more numerous grew the man-made ordinances laid upon the shoulders of believers in the name of religion. The one-time liberty of God's children was converted into religious serfdom. Whoever rebelled and tried to live according to his own convictions was punished with death. The blood of millions flowed in the name of religion. The genuine texts of the New Testament disappeared and were succeeded by copies that differed in important points from their originals. Willful forgery was resorted to in order to lend the authority of the Bible to the man-made opinions and strictures that had been introduced in the course of time. It was a repetition of that state of things which God complained about so bitterly in the Old Testament through His prophets. How can you say, "We are wise"? We are in possession of God's law. Lo, the pen of the falsifying copyists has converted it into lie. The wise men must therefore be ashamed and dismayed. They have thrown away the word of the Lord. What wisdom do they possess then? Modern scientific research has disclosed the fact that these forgeries extended like a devastating plague to all of the ancient documents. The Bible, the Church Fathers, the writings of Jewish and pagan authors, all of them were altered, to support the false religious doctrines that were current at the time. This was all done out of sight of the common people, who accepted unquestioningly the so-called religious truths and interpretations presented to them by their spiritual leaders, and bequeathed them to their children and their children's children. And so it is to the present day. Religion is a legacy which all of us inherited from our parents and teachers, without stopping to use our own judgment as to its truth. Most people, it might be added, are not in a position to do so. For this reason, most of us who today are Christians would have been equally zealous followers of the Jewish or Mohammedan faith, if our parents had been Hebrews or Muslims. This was not so in the days when men were in communication with the good spirit world. Then they could ask, "What is truth?" and they received an answer. It was for this reason that Paul exhorted the early Christians to seek counsel of God, if their views on any point differed from his own. And if in any matter you are of a different opinion, God will make it clear to you. So plain a reference to the only way to arrive at the truth as that given in the foregoing passage by the greatest Christian apostle would have been impossible a few centuries later. Whoever disbelieved the doctrines taught by the church, or whoever tried to arrive at the truth by inquiring of God, after the custom of the old Israelites or the early Christians, fell under the ban of the church and not infrequently perished at the stake. It is true that the unorthodox are no longer consigned to the flames, because today the church has lost the power to ignite them, but the ban remains, and it would fall upon the greatest of the early church fathers if they were alive today and taught those doctrines which in their time they preached to the Christian people. The path that led to God's spirit world has been blocked with rubble, and with it the road leading to the truth. Man-made opinions and rules have been used to erect religious structures in which mankind is invited to have a seat. Hundreds of creeds claim to be the dispensers of truth, one destroying what the other adores, one proclaiming as the unvarnished truth what the other condemns as abominable heresy. Mankind can be freed from these fetters of error only if God will again today send us His spirits as heralds of the truth, as He did in the earlier millenniums. It is not the dead or the kingdom of darkness or fallible men to whom we must turn, but to God. He is the same God today that He was then. He is no respecter of persons. He loves the people of today as dearly as he loved those of past ages. And as then he revealed himself to mankind through his messengers, so will he today. It is to be expected that the churches will do their utmost to obstruct this road to the truth. This they must, since they will be fighting for their very existence. They consider themselves the infallible disseminators of truth. Every one of them has its pope, whether or not he wears a tiara. Any instruction through God's messengers would be looked upon as destructive competition that endangers the continued existence of the church, since it is to be feared that the truths revealed by God's spirits will not be in agreement with the tenets held by the churches. Obviously, there can be only one truth. Either this is in the possession of one of the many creeds, in which case all other creeds are in error, or else the truth is not to be found in any of them. When all is said, these words from Goethe's Faust apply to all religions without exception. In gaudy pictures there is little clarity, a wealth of error and a grain of truth. For 25 years I was a Catholic priest. I believed that mine was the true religion, was it not, indeed, the faith of my parents, my teachers and my spiritual advisors? Even if the proofs of its veracity did not completely convince me, I had no reason for refusing to accept that which was accepted as true by all of my fellow Catholics. Furthermore, any voluntary doubt as to the truth of the tenets of my church would have been mortal sin according to its teachings. I knew nothing of the possibility of communicating with the spirit world. My acquaintance with Spiritism was confined to reading about it in the daily papers. I regarded it as a swindle and as self-deception. Then came the day on which I took, involuntarily, my first step towards contact with the spirit world. I experienced things that moved me to the depths of my soul. Once this step had been taken, I could not, dared not stop. I was compelled to go on in my search for clarity. Cautiously I advanced, keeping in mind the words of the Apostle Paul, "Put to the test all spirit communication, hold fast only to that which is good." It was only that which is good that I wanted. I was seeking the truth, ready to accept it, whatever the cost. I knew that God does not desert the sincere, unselfish seeker, and that, as Christ said, He will not give a stone to those who humbly ask for bread. I was also clearly aware of the serious consequences of my actions. I saw my position as an ordained minister, my entire material existence, my future here on earth destroyed, if I persisted. I knew that insults, persecution and suffering in immense abundance would be my lot. But the truth was more than worth it. I found the truth on the new road I had taken. It brought me inner freedom and happiness. The outward troubles that I suffered in consequence and that persist until today cannot disturb the inner peace that I have won. It is the purpose of this book to describe the path that brought me into communication with the spirit world and laid the truth open to me. The book has been written in a spirit of love for my fellow men, regardless of their creed or outlook on life. It is intended for all seekers after the truth, as a guide for all those who desire to communicate with the good spirit world in order to reach the truth and God by the shortest path. Guidebooks for those who travel about the earth are written by persons who have visited the places that they describe in the texts of their works. Such books are not written for people who expect to stay at home, but for those who want to get to know places hitherto unfamiliar to them. This book of mine is meant to be a guidebook of that sort. It is designed to direct the reader to that bridge on which the spirit messengers from the beyond meet us. Whoever, in the light of what is herein set out, steps upon that spirit bridge will find every statement that appears in this book fully confirmed. I do not, therefore, expect any of my readers to accept at face value the statements contained in this book, without subjecting them to further proof. If they did, they would be basing their beliefs regarding the most important questions of life on the dictum of a fallible human being. This they must not do, for my assertion that the truths I have set down in my book derive not from me and my own thinking but from communication with the good spirit world in the beyond could be deliberate misleading or self-deception on my part. I, as a weak, fallible and sinful man, can claim no greater trustworthiness than any of my fellow men. I therefore do not ask to be believed blindly. But one thing I do ask, that the truth that was revealed to me be verified by the same road by which I found it. This road has been accurately described by me so that no one may fail to find it. The educated and uneducated, the rich and poor alike, all can travel it. No preparation, no special training, is required. No tolls are collected. Only one thing is indispensable, the desire for the truth. Those who seek it must be ready to accept the truth the moment it is presented to them in a convincing way, and they must be willing to model their lives accordingly. This book is not written for those who will not accept these terms. For them, no way leads to the truth, for God manifests His truth only to those who are of good will. Those who do not have the desire for truth, who are not ready to explore the road that I am pointing out, thereby forfeit the right to pass judgment on my book. If, for instance, a chemist were to announce to the world that he had found a method of making gold by combining certain substances, and if he were to describe his process minutely, only those would be capable of expressing an intelligent opinion as to his claims who themselves had performed the experiments described by the chemist, and who had faithfully followed all of his directions. I am certain that this book contains the truth, for I know whom I have believed. I need not fear that those who follow the path indicated by me will find anything to conflict with what I found. Everyone who has heretofore followed my advice and has sought to enter into communication with the good spirit world has had experiences precisely like my own. Nevertheless, my book is sure to encounter many bitter opponents, not so much among the great mass of the people as in those circles for which the acceptance of the truth would mean heavy material sacrifices, the clergy of the various religious denominations. The creed they have been preaching to their congregations has provided them with a livelihood. If, now, in consequence of a change in their way of seeing the truth, they are compelled to make alterations in the things they profess, they will cease to be clergy of their respective creeds and lose their daily bread, which their position has hitherto guaranteed them. To give up a life position and to go out into the uncertainties of the world poor and beset by enemies is one of the greatest sacrifices a person can make. Not many will make it. They would sooner do without the truth. It was for this reason that the Jewish priests waged so bitter a war on Christ and his doctrines. Their livelihood was in danger. They did not study Christ's teachings to enable them to say whether these were right or wrong, but unloosed their deadly hatred upon him whose words threatened to alienate the people from them and thus to undermine their influence with the masses. This is why he had to die, the curse of being the most relentless opponent of the truth, of those who sought it and of those who proclaimed it, rests to the present day on the priesthood of all religions. With fire and the sword, the priesthood has slain millions under the outward flag of battling against heresy, just as the Jewish priests in condemning Christ hid behind the accusation, he has blasphemed God. But the real reason, then as in later ages, was their fear of the total or partial loss of temporal influence, worldly honors, offices and revenues. Of course there have been and still are exceptions, today perhaps more than before. But these latter-day Nicodemuses can no more prevent the spiritual leaders of today from passing the death sentence upon the truth than could the first Nicodemus. The clergy of today will therefore not only repudiate my book, but will refuse to test the veracity of the statements it contains in the way herein described. And yet, it is a path that everyone can take with a clear conscience. Or is it perhaps reprehensible for a clergyman or a layman to sit down, alone or in company with others, to worship God in the privacy of his home, turning to him with song and prayer, and begging of him the fulfillment of Christ's promise, "If you, then, being evil, know how to give good gifts unto your children, how much more shall your heavenly Father give a Holy Spirit to them that ask him?" Is it by any possibility a sin to study the truths of the Holy Scriptures at such a service, to discuss them with others and to pray for true insight? Is it a sin to join hands on such an occasion after the manner of the early Christians and within a composure to concentrate one's thoughts on higher things, repenting of human mistakes, forgiving one another and beseeching God to help us and to send us the Spirit of truth that Christ promised to his followers? Is there anyone who cannot do these things with a clear conscience? More than this I do not ask, for this road, and no other, was the one I traveled when I experienced what my book relates. No special privileges were extended to me, I received only that which any sincere searcher will receive. Indeed, many who follow my trail may receive far greater revelations than I did. The fact that the things we learn in this way seem so incredible is no reason for refusing to set out upon the path indicated, for God expressly promises to show us the unbelievable in the words, "Ask me, and I will answer you, and show you great and incredible things which you did not know." The author. Easter, 1932. Part 1. My first step towards communication with the spirit world. So I thought about it, trying to understand, but it was too hard for me, until I entered into communication with the spirit world of God. It was late in the summer of 1923. At that time, I was the Catholic priest of a small rural community. In addition to my clerical duties, I was in charge of a charitable association, whose headquarters lay in a nearby city. I made two trips a week to the office of this association in order to attend to the charitable activities. It happened one day while I was at the office that a man came in and asked me, "What is your opinion of Spiritism?" Before I could answer, he went on to tell me of his own experiences, relating that he was in the habit of attending a sort of divine service held once a week by a small group, the members of which would pray, read the scriptures, and afterwards discuss the passages they had read. Among those who attended these gatherings was a young boy of about 16 or 17. He was from an unpretentious family, had only an average education, and was an apprentice in a private firm. At the seances, this boy would frequently fall over forward as though dead, but would be immediately pushed back into an upright position in a series of jerks as though by an invisible force, after which he would sit with his eyes closed and impart wonderful teachings to his hearers. He would also answer the questions addressed to him, refusing to answer, however, all queries of a purely materialistic nature. At the conclusion of his teachings, he would again fall forward and instantly regain full consciousness. Of what had happened and what he had spoken, he had not the least recollection. The boy, said my informant, was healthy and bright and felt no discomfort, headache, or any similar symptoms as a result of these occurrences. The man ended his story with the words, "Now, I am anxious to hear from you what you think of it all. But before you express an opinion, please attend one of our meetings, so that you may see for yourself what goes on there. You will have the opportunity to address questions of your own to the boy." I had been listening to him with the closest attention. What was I to say? I neither knew nor understood anything about so-called Spiritism. True, I had occasionally read accounts in the daily papers about the exposing of mediums and about similar spiritistic swindles, nothing at all favorable. But now I, a serious-minded individual and a clergyman into the bargain, was being asked to enter upon this ground and to run the risk of making myself ridiculous. That was out of the question. I was, it is true, tempted by the idea of testing from a scientific point of view the phenomena that had been related to me, if this were possible, when I was alone and in the privacy of my own study. But visit the homes of others and expose myself to gossip, that I did not want to do. I therefore told my visitor frankly that I had had no personal experience with Spiritism and that I was in no position to express an opinion on the things he had witnessed. I said, furthermore, that I had grave doubts as to the propriety of my accepting his invitation to attend one of the meetings he had described, that I owed consideration to my cassock and could not run the risk of being branded openly as a Spiritist, for my presence at these gatherings would undoubtedly soon become generally known. The man would not accept these reasons, but replied, "This is a most important matter, about which you, as a clergyman and a man holding a public position, should be informed. At any rate, I consider it your duty to investigate the matter and, after having done so, carefully and impartially, to form an opinion. This will probably not be the only time you are asked about these matters in your life, for to whom should we laymen look for clarification but to our spiritual leaders, whom we trust to tell us the whole truth? This subject can no longer be disposed of by ignoring it. Right here in Germany, the number of Spiritist circles is growing daily. They can be found in almost every town of any size. I am well aware that the churches want to brush Spiritism aside as a fraud or as the devil's work, but the issue will not be settled in that way. If it is unpleasant consequences that you fear, you need not worry on that score.